And that will take you to slide number one of the presentation, which gives you the presentation title and instructor name. And on this page, you'll also see that you have the slides on the left-hand window. And above the main slide, you'll see you have some navigation icons. You can, there's the orange buttons. You can submit a question by using the question icon that you see above the slide. You don't need to wait until the question and answer period to submit your questions. And actually, you know, if we see some relevant questions coming in during the presentation, we'll try and address them. And, you know, we really do encourage you to be submitting your questions as you go along so that when we get to the question and answer session, we can move right into what you want to know more about. The other thing I want you to know, if you do experience any technical difficulties with the audio stream, you can also use the question mark icon to alert us of your technical difficulty. Please let us know your phone number where we can reach you so that we can try to help troubleshoot your problem. As the presenter moves through the presentation, she's going to announce the number of the slide which she's on. You can advance to the next slide by using the right arrow located above the slide, or you can also click on the appropriate slide number on the left-hand frame. So as I said, we are going to have a few questions, time for questions. And then at the end of the presentation, you'll see that there are some links to additional resources where we've put, you know, a series of documents and web links that would be that are related to this topic that may be of interest to you to take a look at. This information stays with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. The other thing to note is we do archive these seminars, and they're typically put in the archive with the soundtrack. And so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. And then you'll also, again, be able to look at those links for additional resources. We do also have a online feedback form that we do ask you to consider filling out at the end of the presentation. We do look at the comments because we're always trying to improve the content and delivery of our webinars. So on slide two, kind of reviews what all the navigation icons are that we talked through, putting us on star six to mute and pound six to unmute if you are on the phone line. And if you advance to slide three, you'll be on the first slide of our presentation, because I think we're ready to kick off this session now. We have Nancy Jones, who's going to be presenting today's topic, and she is an on-scene coordinator in Region 6, and she's been doing that for 13 years. And prior to that, she did RCRA inspections and enforcement for about 3 years prior to her OSC job. She's worked on numerous removal actions, oil and hazardous waste emergencies and disaster responses, including the Capitol Hill anthrax response, Columbia Shuttle, Hurricane Katrina, Rita, Gustav, Ike, and Deepwater Horizon response. She had many roles during the Katrina response, including the debris coordinator. And since then, she has trained 6 response corps members in Region 6 to be debris coordinators. She's participated in many national and interagency work groups, such as the Emergency Response Technical Work Group, OSC Task Force, OSC Readiness Training Board, and the Contaminated Debris Interagency Working Group in an effort to make EPA's response more efficient and coordinated with other agencies. So welcome, Nancy, and we look forward to your presentation.
Great. Thank you. All right. So this presentation is going to focus on the roles of ESF-10 versus ESF-3, and ESF stands for Emergency Support Function, for those of you who may not be aware, and the coordination between the two emergency support functions. Additionally, I will share some lessons learned from the Katrina, Gustav, and Ike responses. So each year, wildfires, floods, earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, and winter storms generate large amounts of debris, such as building materials, sediments, vegetative debris, personal property, and other materials. Go ahead and advance to slide 4. The authority for federal assistance in natural disasters comes from the Robert T. Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Assistance Act. The Stafford Act authorizes debris removal in the public interest from publicly and privately owned lands and water. The president makes the final decision to declare an area eligible for federal assistance. The National Incident Management System was created by the Department of Homeland Security under Homeland Security Presidential Directive No. 5. NIMS, again, the National Incident Management System, provides a consistent nationwide template to enable federal, state, and local and tribal governments to work together to prepare for, prevent, respond, and recover from domestic incidents. HSPD-5 requires all federal departments and agencies to adopt NIMS and use it in their domestic incident management and emergency prevention preparedness, response, recovery, and mitigation programs and activities, as well as in support of all actions taken to assist state, local, or tribal entities. DHS also developed the National Response Framework. The National Response Framework maps out a uniform federal response and provides supporting mechanisms for disasters. The NRF categorizes the capabilities of federal departments and agencies into 15 emergency support functions to provide the planning, support, resources, program implementation, and emergency services that are most likely to be needed for incidents requiring a coordinated federal response. The emergency support functions that govern natural disaster debris removal are ESF-3, which is Public Works and Engineering, and ESF-10, Oil and Hazardous Materials Response. Okay, you can go ahead and advance to the next slide, which would be slide number 5. Emergency support function 3. The Corps of Engineers is the coordinator and primary agency for emergency support function 3. The Corps of Engineers also plays key roles in support of FEMA and other federal agencies. Typical Corps activities and mission assignments include providing emergency power, establishing temporary shelters and housing, providing temporary roofs, assessing building structural safety, emergency repair of public infrastructure, supporting search and rescue operations, providing safe drinking water and ice, and performing debris removal and disposal operations. The Corps maintains national response teams and regional contracts for debris operations dedicated to supporting state and local governments. Under the National Response Framework, the Corps provides assistance to state and local governments by either a technical assistance mission assignment or a direct federal assistance mission assignment. Under technical assistance, the Corps provides expert advice on all aspects of debris management and helps local governments perform their own debris operations. Direct federal assistance is provided at the request of state and local governments when the scope of work is beyond the capacity of the local governments to perform. This is where the Corps uses its team and contracts to perform debris operation mission in partnership with the local government. One thing to note is that direct federal assistance mission assignments usually require a state match that can be up to 25%. And so as a result, there are times where the state may decide to only request technical mission assignments, and the local entities, whether it's county or parish governments, will hire contractors and then seek reimbursement from FEMA for like public assistance grants or whatever. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more in some other slides, but the state match is an issue and does come into play. Now there are some instances, like during Hurricane Katrina, where the state match was not required, but in most of the disasters, there is some sort of state match. Sometimes it's less than 25%. I've seen it sometimes at 10%. But it is a factor and something to keep in consideration. The same goes for the ESF-10 mission assignments as well. So moving on to the next slide, slide 6, ESF-10. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is the primary federal agency responsible for ESF-10, providing emergency support related to the release of oil and hazardous materials under the National Response Framework. Under this ESF, FEMA funds EPA's management of orphan tanks, drums, and household hazardous waste. EPA provides support to local and state agencies in properly managing debris deemed hazardous, which includes household hazardous waste. This support includes activities such as assessment, data management, technical assistance, outreach, environmental monitoring, collection, and proper disposal of oil and hazardous materials. As with ESF3, ESF10 may receive either a technical assistance mission assignment or direct federal mission assignments to assist in these activities. Even under direct federal assistance, depending on the nature of the disaster, EPA response activities may range from setting up household hazardous waste collection day events for residents to drop off their disaster-generated household hazardous waste, or EPA may be tasked to coordinate with the Corps of Engineers for household hazardous waste collection, or do our own household hazardous waste collection. So there's a range of different activities that EPA may be assigned. Okay, now we're on slide 7. Sometimes EPA provides assistance to ESF3. And these are some of the ways in which that occurs. EPA is the primary federal agency responsible for administering the Resource Conservation Recovery Act. Under RCRA, EPA issues regulations and guidelines to properly manage solid and hazardous waste and provides technical assistance to states and local governments. EPA also regulates PCBs and asbestos. So again, technical assistance about regulatory requirements is a possibility for providing assistance, as well as EPA can provide assistance to the Corps and or local agencies in identifying disposal sites and to conduct monitoring at disposal sites to make sure that inappropriate materials aren't being disposed there. EPA also assists in the assessment and restoration of drinking water and wastewater infrastructure. Okay, on to the next slide, slide 8. Under ESF3, the United States Coast Guard coordinates with the Corps of Engineers in responding to marine debris. The Coast Guard has statutory authority and responsibility to oversee oil and hazardous substance pollution response operations associated with debris removal and salvage operations in the coastal zone in accordance with the National Contingency Plan. While EPA is the coordinator for ESF-10, the Coast Guard is the other primary agency responsible for coordination under ESF-10. So it's important to note not only can the Coast Guard assist the Corps of Engineers under ESF-3 with debris removal, the Coast Guard often also assists EPA under ESF-10 for oil and hazardous material response. So the Coast Guard would be the lead for the hazardous material response in the coastal zone, but once that's been addressed, then often the Coast Guard continues to assist EPA in the inland hazardous material and oil spill cleanup part of the response. Several other agencies play roles in disaster debris removal as well, and all of these are important roles. However, today's focus is more on ESF3 and ESF10, specifically the Corps of Engineers and an EPA and our coordination efforts together. Advance to the next slide, which is slide 9. So in sometime in 2006, the GAO issued a report on basically the government's response to Hurricane Katrina. And one of the things that came out in that GAO report was that there was some confusion between the roles of ESF3 and ESF10, specifically EPA and the Corps. And so EPA, the Corps, and DHS met in October of 2006 to discuss clarification of the roles and duties for debris management. In reality, EPA and the Corps didn't feel like there was any confusion, as was indicated in the GAO report. EPA and the Corps worked really closely together throughout the entire response, and there were times where EPA might have been doing things that would normally have been ESF3 type activities, but at that particular time, the Corps was focusing on trying to dewater the city of New Orleans and needed EPA's assistance, so FEMA then would task EPA to do some things that might typically be an ESF3 type role. And then once that was addressed, that the scope of the ESF-10 mission was so large that there were some activities that the Corps of Engineers offered to assist EPA with to make the ESF-10 response more efficient and effective. And as a result of all these coordination meetings that took place during Katrina, it was decided in this October 2006 meeting that it made sense to kind of formalize some of these coordination efforts and agreements to try to make future responses be as efficient as possible and for FEMA to have a clear understanding of how the two agencies could support and coordinate together. So the following slides are going to talk about some of the activities that were discussed and some of the activities that that would be assigned to the Corps of Engineers if ESF-3 were to get the debris mission assignment. Now, it was agreed that if the Corps was not activated under ESF-3, then these activities would stay under ESF-10 and be EPA's responsibility. So let's go ahead and advance to the next slide, slide 10. So one of the things that was discussed that the Corps would do for efficiency purposes is to do collection, segregation, and transport of hazardous materials incidental to the Corps management of curbside debris and building demolition. And the reason behind that is, again, during the Katrina response, it just became obvious that it was more efficient if the Corps went ahead and did that segregation, because otherwise there were two different agencies that were sorting through debris that was left curbside. And it made more sense to have less handling, A, in the interest of public safety, and two, it, again, just inefficient to have two different people sorting through the same pile of debris. So if the Corps could just go ahead and pull out the hazardous material items, place them in a truck, and bring them to an ESF-10 managed collection site, then those operations would flow a lot smoother. That's what we tried out during Katrina, and it seemed to work really effectively, and so that is the agreement that is in place now. Now, sometimes the scope of the disaster may not be large enough, and so there have been some instances where EPA has still gone ahead and done this, but in some large event like Katrina, in the sake of efficiency, this is what's in place, and there's actually language in the National Response Framework that indicates this arrangement. So further in the agreement, household hazardous waste and the removal of oil and gas from small motorized equipment, which doesn't require OSHA-certified hazmat personnel. That'd be another thing. So not only household hazardous waste, but any, like, if there was, like, a lawnmower, that the lawnmower itself could be handled, could be recycled and handled with the rest of the materials going to a scrapyard, but it needs to have the oil and gas removed. Then that would be something that the Corps of Engineers would do rather than having EPA come handle that. And then the Corps would then transport that the oil and gas to the EPA household hazardous waste collection pad. Again, if EPA for some reason doesn't get the ESF-10 mission assignment, then if the state is doing that function or if a local government has hired a contractor to do that same function, the Corps could still coordinate with those entities as well to handle that. The Corps would also transport this waste. So they do the collection and then they transport it to that collection pad run by either EPA, the state, or the local entity. All right, let's go ahead and advance to the next slide, which is slide 11. So white goods are another item that there was an agreement that the Corps would collect and dispose of the white goods, and the Corps would conduct a freon removal from the white goods and proper recycling and disposal of the freon. So what are white goods? White goods are household appliances such as stoves, refrigerators, washers, dryers, and hot water heaters. These items can be segregated for recycling. Refrigerators and freezers require special attention because they may contain putrescible waste, refrigerants, and capacitors containing PCBs. Refrigerant-containing appliances, including refrigerators, freezers, and window air conditioning units, should be handled by EPA-certified refrigeration technicians or recycling centers to prevent releases. The recycler must certify to EPA that certain standards are being met. Verify. It's important to verify that the recyclers are meeting these requirements by asking them to provide the certification they have sent to EPA. EPA maintains a current list of approved refrigerant recyclers. You can confirm approval status by contacting EPA's ozone protection hotline, which is 800-296-1996, or looking on EPA's website for the Office of Air and Radiation Stratospheric Protection Division. The very last slide has several different websites as resources, and that is one of them. Advancing to the next slide, which is slide 12, electronic waste. That's another waste stream that was an agreement that the Corps would collect and properly recycle or dispose of if they got the debris mission assignment. What is electronic waste? Electronic waste is also referred to as e-waste and can be generated by any type of natural disaster and includes televisions, desktop and laptop computers, stereo equipment, cell phones. Computer monitors and older TVs contain an average of 4 pounds of lead and may require special handling. Some states have specific regulations for handling TVs and monitors. In addition to lead, electronics can contain chromium, cadmium, mercury, beryllium, nickel, zinc, and brominated flame retardants. Electronics that are too damaged to be repaired and reused should be recycled. During the Hurricane Katrina response, Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality specifically stated that they wanted the electronic waste recycled and not to go into their landfill. And so this was the first natural disaster response that I was a part of where this became a large mission, which initially was done under ESF 10. Again, you know, through our agreement with the Corps and Department of Homeland Security folks in 2006, we agreed that it made more sense for it to be part of the ESF-3 mission assignment, more of the Corps to get the ESF-3 mission assignment. All right, advancing to slide 13. So on the flip side of the Corps doing the e-waste recycling, EPA may provide technical assistance for quality assurance, quality control for the above activities as needed. So the Corps may do all the collection, but they may request that, you know, EPA have somebody come periodically do oversight of the freon extraction of the white goods and to come do spot checks of the electronic waste recycling sites to make sure that, you know, EPA felt comfortable and that there wasn't any materials that were being leached or any concerns. So it's just kind of a coordinated effort to, again, you know, new mission assignment that the Corps took on. And so when we kind of transition that over, they thought it'd be a good idea to have a little bit of EPA expertise and assistance to come do some, as I said, quality assurance, quality control. The main effort was transitioned to, again, the Corps of Engineers. Advancing to the next slide, which now we're on 14. Part of the agreement was for EPA under ESF 10 to maintain the removal of hazardous material containers that may have become intermingled with construction debris, such as drums, tanks, cylinders that contain hazardous materials or oil. So those types of items, whether, again, they're drums or tanks or what have you, those would still remain part of the ESF 10 mission. Okay. Before I go on, I'm now on slide 15. Before I go on, I thought I would check in to see if anybody had any questions that they wanted to raise at this point, since we're doing so well on time. I don't see anything that has been submitted online. Does anybody on the phone line have any questions?
Remind of those of you on the phone, if you put us on mute, take us off mute, and you can hit, if you use your keypad, you can hit #6 to unmute.
Okay. I don't hear any. Silence means that everybody must be on board, so we'll go ahead and move on. So, again, we are on slide 15, which is about FEMA's role. FEMA is the lead federal agency that responds to disasters and emergencies to help save lives and protect public health, safety, and property. The Stafford Act uses the term debris removal in a broad sense to encompass the entire process of removing, handling, recycling, and disposing of debris. This regulation declares debris removal to be in the public interest, not only to protect life, public health, and safety, but also to ensure economic recovery of the affected community. I just want to point out, too, that household hazardous waste or hazardous materials also fall into that definition of debris, which is a little bit unusual, but at least, you know, on the EPA side to hear that. But that is the where the materials under ESF 10 fall into the FEMA terminology. FEMA's most visible role in disaster recovery and debris management is in administering the Public Assistance Grant Program. The program provides supplemental federal disaster grant assistance to states, local governments, and certain nonprofit organizations for debris removal and disposal, emergency protective measures, and the repair, replacement, or restoration of disaster-damaged publicly owned facilities and the facilities of certain private nonprofit organizations. Public assistance funds are available to eligible applicants for debris clearance, removal, and disposal operations. So, for example, if the state decides not to request ESF 3 or ESF 10 mission assignments to be issued to the Corps of Engineers and to EPA, again, the state and the local governments can apply for public assistance funds, public assistance grants, to hire their own contractors to do the work. So again, this is kind of what's taken into consideration when the state and local entities decide whether they want to request a technical assistance mission assignment or a direct federal assistance mission assignment. So they basically look at the funds that are going to be necessary and whether or not the matching is going to be an issue or not. So advancing to the next slide, we're on now slide 16, talk about public assistance eligibility. Debris removal work must be necessary to eliminate an immediate threat to lives, public health, and safety. Eliminate immediate threats of significant damage to improved public or private property or ensure the economic recovery of the affected community to benefit the community at large. So that's kind of what the overall qualifications are for there to be an eligibility to receive public assistance funds for debris removal. Next slide, 17. So what activities under debris removal are eligible specifically? And those are listed as debris removal from public right-of-way to allow safe passage of emergency vehicles, and debris removal from public property to eliminate health and safety hazards. Okay, so let's go to the next slide, slide 18. This slide lists several activities which are not eligible for debris removal funds. The one that I really want to point out the most is the bottom one, removal of debris from federal lands. What this means is that, state parks or federally owned lands that are under the control of the Department of Interior are not eligible for Stafford Act public assistance funds. And so while parks, you know, often end up, or reserves, federal reserves, those types of properties, they end up getting just as much debris as everywhere else. And so, for example, during Katrina, Rita, Gustav, and Ike, there was a lot of material that was noted during flyovers that were in these types of properties. And so what we had to do was, we were allowed under our technical assistance mission assignment to identify where there were just from overhead, from flyovers, drums and tanks that were on these properties. And then we gave the list to the Department of Interior. And the Department of Interior had to get their own funding from Congress, get a congressional allocation to do the cleanup. And then they did a memorandum of understanding with EPA and had EPA do the cleanup, but again, with money that from the DOI directly, rather than as part of the FEMA Stafford Act response. So just something a little nuanced to keep in mind, that there are activities that are not eligible for FEMA funding, and you can see there's several others that are listed on the slide as well. Another issue is debris removal from private property is generally not eligible for public assistance grant funding because it's considered the responsibility of the individual property owner. If the property owners move the disaster-related debris to a public right-of-way, such as curbside, the debris may be eligible for removal for a limited amount of time. If the debris on private businesses and residential property is so widespread that public health, safety, or the economic recovery of the community is threatened, FEMA may fund debris removal from private property, but it must be approved in advance by FEMA. So, for example, during the Hurricane Katrina response, EPA received permission on a case-by-case basis to remove hazardous materials from private businesses, such as hardware stores, clinics, and some abandoned facilities, as well as marshlands that happen to be owned by private businesses. However, this permission was not granted during Hurricane Gustav and Ike. So it really had specifically to do with whether it was considered a widespread threat to public health, safety, or economic recovery of the community. During Gustav and Ike, EPA, met with FEMA and tried to work with them to get some limited permission, but it really just didn't meet FEMA's criteria. And so we were only allowed to collect those materials that were on the public right-of-ways. So just something to keep in mind because that was different than Katrina. I see I have a question about asbestos handling. We're going to get to that in a minute, so please be patient with me. And then, there's another question that I see. When hazardous material debris is being brought to separate collection areas for handling, are they moved in full accordance with U.S. DOT hazardous material transportation regulations? During hurricane responses that EPA is doing under ESF-10, EPA pursues getting a waiver from the Department of Transportation so that when we're collecting things curbside off of the public right-of-way and bringing it to a collection pad, we do not need to follow all the U.S. DOT regulations. However, once that material is then packaged and it's being sent to a disposal site or a recycling site, all DOT regulations do apply and are followed. So I hope I answered that question. I'll go ahead and mark it as answered. If you continue to have more questions about that, then please feel free to ask further questions on that. And also, if that commenter wants to email me, my email address is jones.nancy@epa.gov. I can send you an example of one of the waivers that we received from DOT, and I think I even have an example of our request that was sent to DOT. So if you need either of those, I can provide those through email. All right, so we're going to go ahead and move on to slide 19, and start talking about disaster debris disposal alternatives. After a disaster occurs, communities are faced with the dilemma of how to use their existing capacity for recycling, composting, combustion, and disposal of natural disaster debris. Establishing reuse recycling as a priority at the beginning of a disaster response is important. The affected states or state need to make FEMA aware so that the Corps of Engineers and EPA and other agencies doing debris removal will make reuse recycling a priority in their contracting strategy. And this was done, as I said, during Katrina. Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality stated that up front when they met with EPA when we first formed Unified Command together. Also, staging and storage areas are needed to store, separate, or process prior to disposal or recycling. So these are all things to keep in mind, that you need to have the proper space to do staging and separation. Let's move on to the next slide, slide 20. Reuse. EPA recommends that any disaster debris management plan include a strategy for reuse, recycling, and mulching composting. Due to the potentially large volumes of material produced in a natural disaster, recycling and reuse will lessen the burden on disposal facilities, potentially cut costs, and provide a valuable material resource. Recycling conserves natural resources by replacing them with recovered products that perform the same function. During the collection of orphan containers, which again, that's what we refer to as tanks and drums and such that contain hazardous materials or oil. So during the collection of these orphan containers, during an event such as a hurricane, responsible parties are often identified for large tanks, totes, and drums. An integral part of the process and the recovery of orphaned items is the retrieval of items by their responsible party or owner. This process allows responders to deal with the tanks of truly unknown origins and eases the burden placed on the collection staff. In addition, cost savings are realized by EPA and also by the responsible party. The responsible party is usually identified by details found on the container, such as the company name, phone number, manufacturer's number, or a state agency identification number. Most tanks will have a state identification number. And again, the property owners usually want these tanks back. And so doing the research to track them down and let them know that their tank or drum has been found is often well received, and it's worth the time to do. Local landowners can also be a source of information regarding ownership of tanks in a specific area. The process of determining and contacting the responsible party should be documented. EPA and the responsible party, EPA has the responsible party sign a claim form when they retrieve their item. EPA allows third parties to retrieve containers or tanks when a responsible party cannot be determined. Again, the third party must complete paperwork, taking responsibility for the container and releasing EPA from liability. Now, I just want to clarify when I'm using the term responsible party, if many of you may be familiar with Superfund and CERCLA, and there's some sort of, you know, cost associated with being a responsible party and that reimbursement, that type of thing. That's not the case here during a natural disaster. Responsible party just means the owner of that material. The natural disaster caused the orphan container to be displaced, and therefore we're just using that term because it's common EPA terminology, but it doesn't mean that anybody's going to get a bill or anything like that. We're doing this work, again, under ESF 10. Just it makes more sense to work with the owner to take back their drum or their tank or tote rather than for EPA to go to the cost of actually having to cut up a tank and dispose of the contents of it. So it just makes more sense for the owner to be contacted, and if they're able to remove the item themselves, then that's fantastic, or if they can come pick it up from the EPA collection pad, then that's helpful and beneficial as well, too, and there's less material that's ending up going into a landfill or that has to be disposed of or recycled in some other way. So something to keep in mind. And then there's also in the resource section of Fluin site, there is the responsible party container recovery plan that has all the forms and stuff that EPA used during the Hurricane Ike response in Texas. So if you want to take a look at that whole plan and you want to, you know, maybe modify some of the forms that we used for our record of communication and for release of liability forms, you're welcome to do that. You'll probably want to show it to your legal staff and tweak it and make it specific for your own agency. But feel free to use what we have as a template. And I hope that will be helpful to you. All right, so we're going to move on to slide 21 and talk about recycling. So again, the slide discusses benefits of recycling, and as I mentioned previously, LDQ did ask EPA to make recycling a priority for our ESF-10 response during Katrina, and so as such, over 7 million pounds of organic materials that were collected by EPA from Katrina, Rita, Gustav, and Ike were recycled as alternative fuels as part of EPA's response. We also recycled electronic waste, and as a result, we were able to recover copper, gold, nickel from the electronic circuitry for reuse. Things to consider when evaluating the merits of conventional disposal versus recycling on these types of projects is that while you may spend less on conventional disposal initially, ultimately it costs more than recycling in the long term. When you look at the cost of building new landfills and the monitoring of landfills and that type of thing. So short-term cost savings, but long-term not really so much. While not truly a disadvantage, but a concern, is that when EPA manages a disposal effort, we know that waste is shipped off-site and that the waste is being disposed of at a regulatory-compliant facility through our system of inspection and reporting under CERCLA. Recyclers are not subject to the same kind of inspection and reporting requirements as disposal facilities. So with this reduced scrutiny, there is a potential that we may be transferring hazardous materials to future Superfund sites. However, to mitigate that, EPA does more due diligent research, and our contractors and transportation disposal staff folks are taking a lot of time and effort to make sure that selected recyclers are actually performing what they've committed to because of the decision-making data that is not as readily available for the recyclers as with the disposal facilities. But again, if you just dedicate some of your staff and some of your contracting staff, again, if you're an agency, to do this research, then it really does have a lot of benefits. It's just, there's not as much information as readily available as there are with the disposal sites. Because, basically, as I'm saying, there's all these EPA and state records of inspections at the hazardous waste disposal sites, and not as much available on the side of the recyclers. But, again, it is possible. Coordinate with your state and your local folks. Do some research, and you can find information out that will make you feel confident that you're making a good choice on where to send things to be recycled. Also, if you look at the EPA website, there are, again, in my resources section, there's a website that does list various recyclers that I highly recommend that you check out. So I encourage you to take advantage of all those resources. All right, let's go to the next slide, waste energy. Typically, non-hazardous waste energy facilities can handle various types of natural disaster debris. Additional storage capacity may be necessary as the volume generated may be more than the combustor can handle. Vegetative debris and woody biomass can be used as a fuel or an energy source, which has environmental and economic benefits. Another thing to consider is that nearby power plants may accept biomass. One way to evaluate potential biomass markets is to involve the state forestry or natural resources agency. They may be able to provide you some ideas and some facilities that you can turn to that would be able to take this type of waste. One thing that I learned, I used a document called the Planning for Natural Disaster Debris Guideline, guidance that was, again, that's on the resource, the section of this presentation. Will be the last slide. So a lot of the information in this presentation comes directly from that. And so when I was doing the research for this, I learned something that I wasn't aware of about the Katrina response. In Louisiana and Mississippi, a company called Green Energy Resources, which is a company that provides renewable energy, purchased 1 million tons of vegetative debris from Louisiana and Mississippi in September of 2005 after Hurricane Katrina. The debris was sent to the United Kingdom to fulfill an annual contract for more than 5 million tons of wood chips. The company later purchased another 1 million tons for use in power plants in northeastern United States, which, again, I wasn't familiar with because I knew that during the Katrina response there was an issue with the Formosa termite, and so I'm not sure how we were able to get around the Formosa termite ban issue and send this material off. But I know that there was a lot of research done about treating some of the debris, and so I guess that's what was done here. So I think that's fantastic, and in areas that don't have to worry about Formosa termites, then this is an excellent option. In Texas, a company called American Biorefining, an alternative power company in Nacogdoches, Texas, salvaged millions of tons of shattered trees, branches, and other forest debris left behind by Hurricane Rita in 2005. The vegetative debris was shredded into biomass fuel and shipped to various European countries to be used for power generation. So anytime there's opportunities like that, rather than just putting something in a landfill, then that's definitely encouraged. So moving on to slide 23, disposal options. Once reuse, recycling, and waste-to-energy opportunities are exhausted, either due to economics or otherwise not practicable, the remaining debris should be disposed of properly. Most of the debris generated from natural disasters is non-hazardous and can be disposed of as appropriate in a construction and demolition landfill, a municipal solid waste landfill, or a non-hazardous solid waste combustor regulated by a state agency. MSW and C&D landfills have acceptance criteria that differ and differing requirements, and so therefore it's important to check with the state to determine the appropriate landfill requirements to ensure compliance. And every state has slightly different acceptance criteria for these types of landfills, so you really do need to coordinate really closely with your state agencies on this. Again, you know, not only at the beginning of a response, but even prior to a response as part of your debris management preparedness planning. Monitoring incoming disaster debris is important to make sure that debris has been segregated and inappropriate materials are not commingled. This was a big issue during Hurricane Katrina because there were a couple landfills that received some emergency permits to operate at the beginning of the response. And this was extremely controversial, and so it was extremely important for EPA and the Corps and FEMA to all be monitoring the incoming debris at the various landfills to ensure that the hazardous materials were not commingled into the truckloads that were coming in to drop off. So keep that in mind, and that's an area where EPA can again provide some technical assistance to ESF3 by providing additional sets of eyes to be looking at that. I know that ESF3 usually has their own debris monitors, and FEMA actually provides some folks to do this as well. But again, EPA has expertise specifically in hazardous materials and identification of these and how they should be handled. So this is an area where EPA can provide assistance as well. All right, moving on to slide 24, open burning. Open burning includes both burning debris in an open pit and burning in an air curtain incinerator or burner. The air curtain burning method incorporates a pit constructed by digging below grade and a blower. Some incinerators are portable and utilize a pre-manufactured pit in lieu of an on-site constructed earth or limestone pit. Portable air curtain incinerators or burners are the most efficient burning systems available and are more suitable for areas with shallow groundwater tables, sandy soils, and where opacity or smoke must be kept at a minimum. Open burning is often subject to significant public concern and may or not be allowed by the state or local government. I mean, during Katrina, there were some parishes that didn't allow open burning of vegetative debris. Sorry about that. had a little disturbance in our office. Not sure what that was. Okay. I think I can continue on. All right, let's see where I was. I apologize about that. All open burning should be conducted in accordance with state regulations and should not violate requirements under the state implementation plan pursuant to the Clean Air Act. No treated wood or asbestos should be burned. I actually coordinated with EPA's Office of Research and Development on a study to determine whether or not burning construction and demolition debris was a good idea or not. And so we did a small test. We burned three C&D houses, and that study hasn't been published yet. It's in the process of peer review right now. But if you're interested in learning more about that study, again, you can contact me. My email address is jones.nancy@epa.gov, and I'll find out what the status is and provide you whatever update that I can. But in general, I can tell you that the decision was that it's not something that EPA recommends. If there's an extreme emergency and you're able to do this type of burning in an air curtain burner in a very remote area where there are not people that will be exposed, specifically residents, if you're outside of the community, then there can be some exceptions to make burning C&D material work and that it has some benefits, but you know, definitely it's a short-term solution, and it's not recommended for wide use for waste minimization purposes. So just to keep that in mind. Let's see, looks like, and I've got some pictures of the air curtain burner on that slide as well. Let's see, I think I've got a question online. Does debris management plans consider vegetative material to be used for composting? Yes. So mulching, grinding and mulching vegetative debris and then using it for composting is definitely a potential, especially to use as a landfill cover is something that is definitely very common practice and one way to use the material, and then, you know, again, depending on the state and local entities and their comfort with using it for residential composting is something you'd have to discuss with them. The issue behind that is making sure that the vegetative debris truly doesn't have anything commingled in it. As long as it's free of any of the construction demolition material, then it's probably going to be okay. But I definitely would coordinate with the state and local entities that were part of the response to make sure that they were checking into that and that that they felt comfortable. But that is something that that is a possibility and should definitely be looked into. So and taken into consideration. All right, so I'm going to mark that one as answered. Again, if you have a follow-up, then feel free to go ahead and submit additional questions about that. I noticed I did have some state folks who had signed up, and so if you have further comments about that, then feel free to go ahead and post them. Even if they're not a question, I can read your responses and your reactions to that. So, because I would like for this to be interactive, if folks have concerns or opinions or want to further expand upon something, then post away and we can have a discussion. Because we're doing fairly good on time. All right. So moving on to slide 25. All right, so during the course of a natural disaster, materials are generated that have the potential to harm human health or the environment. Examples of materials gathered during previous natural disasters and handled as hazardous waste include automotive and marine batteries, pesticides, automotive oils, fuels, solvents, and paint thinners and strippers. There's many other items that fall into this category as well, but these are just examples. Separating these materials into appropriate categories prevents incompatibles from reacting. Segregating debris is best performed at the original deposited point, such as curbside or field separation. debris can also be segregated at temporary storage sites. However, I really kind of discourage that. That should be like a second round of segregation. You know, the first round of segregation should occur curbside or in the field to the extent possible, do as much segregation as possible in the curb, at curbside. And then the material that's taken to the main debris staging area, you can do secondary segregation there. But it's really better to do as much segregation as possible right up front to really prevent materials from getting further commingled. And also, too much handling of commingled material allows for more releases to happen. And so you want to prevent release and, you know, contact with material that has been released to the extent possible by doing that segregation curbside. Once the hazardous materials are segregated, they can be brought to, again, the ESF-10 managed household hazardous waste collection site, or again, if ESF-10 hasn't been activated, the local or state managed hazardous material collection site. Slide 26. So now I'm going to talk about some household hazardous waste collection practices that were kind of refined and kind of made into the best management practices during Katrina, Gustav, and Ike. And again, this is very EPA-centric, but hopefully it can translate to your agency if you end up being the primary household hazardous waste collector. So coordinate with the states, and again, you know, I said this is primary EPA-specific, so we said region. But so we're encouraging, like, from Region 6, for example, where I'm from, to coordinate with all the states in our region ahead of time. Again, if you're work for the Corps of Engineers, then in the district that you work in, same idea. Coordinate with the states in your area of responsibility before an event, you know, for pre-planning purposes, to identify possible locations for household hazardous waste collection sites to be located. Saves time, and then in addition, best locations are usually public property, county or state property. So again, it's good to identify that up front so you have a game plan ahead of time, and you're able to actually get to the collection faster if you already have some areas already identified. And then you're going to need to coordinate with your legal staff on getting access agreements signed. So again, if you're able to pick spots out ahead of time as part of a planning effort, then that's fabulous, and you can go ahead and get access agreements signed in place. Otherwise, you know, doing it at the beginning of the disaster, I mean, it can take time, but it needs to be done. It's EPA always feels it's important for us to have access agreements, and I know that the Corps does too. And then coordinating with the state on obtaining EPA ID numbers once an incident has occurred. So, again, the EPA identification number is usually for permitted hazardous waste sites. So while during a disaster you're not actually going through the whole process of getting a permit and all that, and you may or may not be storing things for 90 days, you want to follow the intent of and therefore go ahead and obtain the ID number and coordinate with the state on any waiver needed for a permit if you're going to be storing waste for over 90 days. These are all things that, you know, EPA did during Katrina, that we, you know, obtained paperwork again, you know, during emergency situations. There is the flexibility to waive certain things, but some things not, and having an EPA ID number is actually essential. Most of the ID numbers actually come from the state, even they're called EPA ID numbers, but they're essential for when you're filling out hazardous waste manifests for the transportation in the end when you're taking it to its final disposal. I've got some questions that I'm going to address. Got a question, how do you deal with human or animal remains? So this is something that EPA has not been assigned through ESF-10 as of yet. Definitely not human remains. Animal remains, there is some some new information I've heard about that may become a responsibility of EPA in the future. Human remains have never been our responsibility, and there's never been a discussion of that. But animal remains, there is the potential, but we haven't had to address this yet. So that would be a new tasking for us, and it's something that we would definitely need to coordinate with other agencies on. And I noticed this question came from USDA. We probably would want to consult with you guys and get more information from you if we actually did receive this as a mission assignment. But as of yet, this has not been a mission assignment that EPA has had to do under ESF-10. I'm not certain whether the Corps of Engineers has had to do this under ESF-3 or not. So if you want to post something and I can share it with everybody, that would be great. Another question, came from somebody with the Corps of Engineers. And the question is, how realistic is it to consider wood frame building debris for waste energy, given one, the volume of material present at one time, and two, potential for contamination by lead-based paint, asbestos, et cetera? And he says, I would suggest that there are areas, neighborhoods, where presence of such contaminants is likely and therefore ought not to be considered for waste energy disposition. However, there are also newer neighborhoods where presence of these materials is unlikely and would be more feasible for waste energy disposition. Segregation of wood materials would be necessary. Finally, what influence does EPA and or FEMA have on waste disposal contracts to require segregation for waste energy and or recycling? This peacetime contract development is critical to implementation. Immediate post-disaster response is too late. These are excellent points, and I'd like to thank you for bringing that up. You are completely right that there are many neighborhoods where wood frame housing debris would not be suitable. New Orleans was a perfect example because lead paint and asbestos were definitely issues, and so waste energy was not an option there. And as you pointed out, there are newer neighborhoods in other parts of the country, specifically in California and other places, where it's not as much of an issue, and it is a possibility. However, again, it's going to be really important to coordinate with the state agency, the State Department of Environmental Quality, to make sure that that is the case and that this material is appropriate. It's going to be more appropriate for vegetative debris and woody biomass rather than anything that's going to fit into the construction and demolition category. As I mentioned, that Office of Research and Development study I did for even doing open burning, we noted concerns about that. But waste energy has a little bit more safeguards than open burning because many of them are fitted with scrubbers and such, and may even be permitted to handle some of that type of material as far as lead paint, but not asbestos for sure. So it's something that you're definitely going to need to coordinate with your state agency and verify that this material is suitable or not. So it's really going to require some assessment of the situation before decisions are made. And it's really best if you can do some pre-planning with the state agencies in advance and talk about if you can hang on just a second and then I'll we can discuss. What I was finishing up saying is pre-planning, ahead of time with your state, you can talk about areas that you know would definitely not be suitable and newer neighborhoods that potentially there would be some possibility, and identify waste energy companies that are within the state and what their capabilities for taking this type of material are. So that's all something that, again, as you mentioned, during peacetime contract development is critical, and because it does take too long during the disaster. As far as what influence does EPA and FEMA have on waste disposal contracts, I would say, what needs to occur is that when a disaster occurs, a state has to establish and tell FEMA right away that recycling is a priority to them, and they are willing, to potentially pay more for their, 25% match. so that, you know, recycling can be done. As far as the time that goes into peacetime contracting, you know, FEMA doesn't pay for that. So that's something that, you know, EPA tries to coordinate with the states in each of our regions, so that we have some disaster planning done ahead of time for our hazardous material part of recycling. And, you know, again, encourage the Corps to do the same. And I know that I have many contacts with the Corps engineers, and I know that some of that does occur. There's websites also available that identify waste energy facilities in various states and what their capabilities of acceptance criteria are and that type of thing. So I know that some of that resource information is out there and is available, and it's just a matter of going ahead and coordinating with the state on that type of information. All right, now somebody's trying to ask a question, so go ahead. Excuse me?
It sounds like someone might be having another conversation. I guess if you have a question, speak up, and if not, could you keep us on mute?
Yep. 5.8. In Virginia, outside of Richmond, Virginia.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to be listening to us. The person who's speaking, could you put us on mute, please?
I guess that's because I'm higher up or something. This is a big old concrete building. I mean, where's...
He's talking about, there was just an earthquake in Washington, D.C.,
yeah, I felt it. That was the disturbance that I felt. That
Texas, third floor.
Unfortunately, this person is talking to someone about it. I will try and globally mute this call.
I listened to a conference call. I don't know where they are, but they didn't.
Unfortunately, I don't have the instructions in front of me on how to do that.
Okay.
I apologize, Nancy.
It's okay, and at some point, if I'm told to leave the building, because everybody else did run out and leave.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, at this point, I don't feel like in danger. I didn't, you know, I'm not feeling any other, effects, so I think I'm okay. But if somebody does come in and tell me to leave, then I wasn't sure that it was an earthquake. I wasn't sure what had happened. So
I was sitting here too, and I'm like, why is my house shaking?
Exactly. Well, there was a lot of noise. I don't know if y'all could hear it on the line when when it happened. But anyway.
I found the instructions. I can. What I'm gonna do is globally mute the call because this gentleman is. You'll have to hit #5. Did you hear me?
Okay. Okay.
Okay. Hold on a second.
We'll have a pause.
The leader has muted your line. To unmute your line, press #6.
So I guess Nancy hit #6.
Okay.
Hey, back.
Can you hear
okay,
me?
Good. Sorry about that, everyone.
Okay.
So everyone should be muted, but you and me, Nancy. And if when we get to a question session, I can tell everyone how to unmute themselves. So go ahead, and if you at any point need to leave because of safety, just go.
Okay. Sounds
okay.
Good. All right. So I believe we are on slide 27. And I did actually get another comment about the earthquake. Let's see what that says. The earthquake was felt from New York to Virginia. Evacuations from building were ordered in some locations. Please check your office for instructions.
Thanks
for that information. That was from our USDA friend in Kansas City, so I appreciate that. Hopefully there won't be an issue, but let's continue on and we'll see what happens. Hopefully there won't be any more aftershocks or anything. But anyway, all right. So we're on slide 27 now. helpful hazardous waste collection best practices continued again to coordinate with states in your area before and beginning of incident to identify any special concerns or requirements state may have regarding, you know, recycling electronic waste and fuel tanks. The next slide, 28, dissemination of informational flyers to residents on curbside segregation and why is important to keep these materials off the landfill comes in handy. Again, when residents come back home and they're taking stuff out of their house and placing it curbside, if, again, they're educated about segregating their materials instead of commingling it, it does help with the collection effort. Outreach to individuals on the streets. In many cases, EPA or the Corps are the first federal agency to reach the public. So, again, you know, when responders, whether they're EPA or the Corps or if this is another agency who may be doing this type of work, you know, come in contact with individuals and you see them placing stuff curbside, do outreach. Talk to them and again, if your agency has created flyers, then passing the flyers out at this point, keeping some in your collection vehicle and passing them out. Again, this will end up helping you. So, all right. So moving on to the next slide, which is slide 29. Mapping and tracking, keeping close tabs on the routes that are driven by each of the teams. And again, at EPA, we use ICS, and so the Incident Command System. And so usually it's division supervisor is the name of the ICS position that is over a certain area of the collection activity. So these folks can identify which areas need more emphasis the following days. Additionally, field observers can be utilized to scout out areas where new household hazardous waste appears and advise the division supervisors of obstacles they may encounter, meaning like a tree in the way or something like that. So, moving on to slide 30, and I appreciate the comment from my friend in Hawaii. All right. So slide 30, identify a technical expert to serve as a debris coordinator. Again, during really big responses like Katrina, there is such a need to have somebody dedicated, and this is the role that I served, to coordinate with FEMA, with the various parish folks, as well as the state and the Corps of Engineers and the various contractors to coordinate debris segregation activities and make sure that everybody is following the same rules and coordinating together and resolving any issues that come up. So having conference calls and meetings. Oh, hang on. I'm getting...
People continue working, or if they feel... that they need to leave, they are...
Okay, they told us we could go ahead and stay. So, just wanted to pass that along. Hang on. Well, hang on just a second while I've got the overhead speaker announcement.
Or if they're concerned for their family, they are authorized to leave for the day. Thank you.
Okay. So, they said that we could stay or leave, so I'm going to continue on. So, if anybody else is in the area and you're impacted and you have to drop off, then I understand, and, you know, this presentation will be available for you to look at online at a later time. But for those of you who are able to stay with us, then I'll keep on. But I'm going to wait for the overhead announcement to stop again. Hang on one second.
Continue working, or if they feel that...
Okay. I think they stopped. If I get interrupted again, then I do apologize. All right, so appoint a debris coordinator and, again, coordinating these meetings and conference calls with all the various parties was extremely valuable during Katrina. So we followed that same practice during Gustav and Ike, and I highly recommend it. This person can also coordinate, again, if you use ICS or you're familiar with that, the operations section chief role and the incident commander. The debris coordinator can kind of be a liaison, basically, to talk to the operations folks and incident command about issues that are coming up in the field that they are made aware of through all their meetings with the Corps of Engineers and the other various contracting folks, whether it's, again, parish or county contractors. So it ends up being a good information loop to have that debris person be able to feed information back and vice versa. Katrina was the first response where we had a debris coordinator position, and it's really kind of taken off, and many regions have debris coordinators now. So I encourage you to look into that. I know that the Corps of Engineers definitely does have folks as members of your PRT that kind of do that role. They do many other things, but those individuals were the ones that I coordinated with during Katrina, Gustav, and Ike, and they're extremely knowledgeable folks and are familiar with EPA and EPA's role. And so it works out well to have an EPA counterpart for them to coordinate with. So the next slide 31, again, coordination with the Corps, having daily, weekly coordination with the Corps engineer subject matter experts on debris to help resolve and prevent issues in the field is extremely important and helped out a lot. Move on to the next slide 32, showing some pictures in the next few slides. This is an example of poor segregation. I mean, at the beginning of Katrina, it was a learning process, you know, as we coordinated with the various contractors who were bringing materials to us. And so this is a slide where, you know, we needed to work with contractors on bringing things to us and that was segregated better. And, you know, by the end of the response, things were great. But, you know, this is not a good example of how things should look. For one, that drum could tip over at any time. Materials in those bags are not necessarily compatible. You've got, you know, flammables next to reactives. It's just not a safe situation.
May I have your attention,
okay, hang on a second. Go over an announcement one more time.
Please.
Be patient with me.
This is Security Management Division. We have suffered an earthquake. We are asking that people either continue to work, or if they are concerned about their family, they are authorized to leave for the day. Again, this is the Security Management Division. We have suffered an earthquake. If you can continue to work, or if you're concerned about your family, you can leave for the day. Thank you.
Okay. Same announcement. So I'm going to continue on. So slide 33, another example of some poor segregation. Materials in the tote. Oh, I apologize.
May I have your attention, please? This is Security Management Division. We have suffered an earthquake. We are asking that people either continue to work, or if they are concerned about their family, they are authorized to leave for the day. Again, this is the Security Management Division. We have suffered an earthquake.
For those of you hanging in there, you're very patient, and I do apologize. All right, so moving on to slide 34 is an example of proper segregation. And again, this actually was a suggestion of one of the Corps of Engineers contractors. They came up with this idea, and it worked really well, these little Rubbermaid totes. And able to separate items so you don't have incompatibles sitting next to each other. And so highly recommend this. So please take a look at this, study it, and this is how we encourage household hazardous waste to be delivered to collection sites, regardless of who's running them. So this worked out beautifully, and this is the way it should look. Moving on to slide 35. Other things that worked really well. No, I didn't leave. No, I'm doing a webinar, actually. Sorry about that. Counting items. So local FEMA and EPA headquarters find this information about the number of items collected a day to be valuable for reporting. Having this information also helps the division supervisor, again, that's an ICS term, forecast workload. This information can be used to reduce crew size of the collection pad, disposal frequency, and estimate disposal cost. So, moving on to slide 36, station personnel at the entry of each household hazardous waste collection pad. So if you have somebody kind of posted at the front of the pad, these individuals can be looking at the materials that are brought in to make sure that there's not incompatibles, and also to make sure that there's not materials that are being brought in that just don't need to come in. You know, sometimes there's confusion about what a hazardous material is, and you know, you receive shampoo bottles and things like that that really don't need to be coming to the household hazardous waste collection pad. And so the people who are stationed at the front of the entrance can help educate the people who are bringing the material in so that that type of material isn't dropped off and not continued to be collected. All right, so next slide, 37. Creating a central segregation point at the pad makes for more efficient operation. So again, you know, segregation is the key to the entire response. You do segregation at the curbside, and then, you know, once the core contractors end up bringing material to their own debris staging area and they do some secondary segregation, and then they ultimately bring it to the ESF-10 pad. And at the ESF-10 pad, you have a central area within your site where you do segregation, and you segregate your household hazardous waste into the various different categories of how things are going to be handled, whether it's reactive or flammable or toxic, and it helps you decide how you're going to bulk items. So drivers can spend less time at the pad. The crew can segregate the items and move them to the appropriate location on the pad after the driver has left. Okay, so now moving on to slide 38. Emptying materials from small containers and bulking like materials rather than overpacking the containers saves disposal costs and encourages recycling. So again, if you're able to do this, then this is fabulous. We try to do this as often as we can, but at the height of the Katrina response, we were not able to do this because we were just receiving too large of a volume, and we couldn't keep up with the bulking. So we did it at the beginning of the response, and we did it at the end of the response, but there was a period in the middle of the response where we had to just go ahead and do the overpacking because we were receiving thousands of items a day, and we couldn't keep up with the bulking. And it was more important to get the material off-site than to have too much material stored on site for a long period of time, because that's not necessarily safe. So you have to kind of weigh the situation and figure out what the safest thing to do is. If you are going to do the bulking on site, then I really encourage you to do air monitoring and make sure that your personnel really are trained and have experience in doing it as well. Really requires somebody with a chemistry background. Slide 39, issuing public notices of termination of household hazardous waste collection encourages residents to get their material to the curb as well as to keep them informed. So, you know, obviously FEMA is not going to pay for this to go on forever, and so people need to know, be given a date when the curbside collection is going to stop, and that way they'll be encouraged to get their stuff out to the curb in a timely manner, and that way if their stuff isn't picked up, then they know why, because they're past the deadline. Moving on to slide 40, household hazardous waste hotlines have come in extremely handy on our responses, where we have a contract staff or EPA person who maintain a hotline for residents to call in with questions about what is eligible or how to make arrangements for pickup if they have unusual material that you know can't be picked up right away. And then, you know, we might just make a special drive to their house and have them put it, you know, curbside when we get there. As well as this is an opportunity to, you know, be able to answer questions for folks And if for example, that you receive questions that aren't related to household hazardous waste, it's really handy to have somebody who has done the research and they know other informational numbers to be able to forward people to, because oftentimes, at least it was our experience when we're doing flyers, when we're doing public assistance announcements about our collection activities, then people have access to our phone number, but they may not have another phone number to call and ask questions. But if you have a hotline and you have individuals who are trained and they have information about, you know, the other hotline numbers, about other activities associated with the response, this is a way to share that information with the residents so that the residents have another place to call. So anyway, the public really appreciated it, and I do recommend it. Even if you're not going to end up having a collection pad or doing a, you know, curbside collection activity, it still comes in handy for agencies like EPA and the Corps to have a hotline for residents to ask questions. So that could be part of a technical assistance mission assignment to facilitate helping the state and local folks. So slide 41, daily safety meetings to keep workers informed as to what to do in case of an alarm from one of the air monitoring equipment courses is critical. It's always EPA's practice to have safety meetings every day, and I'm sure that other agencies who are online do the same thing. Now I'm getting to the person's question about asbestos. So we're on slide 42. So thanks for being patient. I hope that you're still on the line and that you've hung in there with me, and that I'll answer your question satisfactorily. So here are some other debris streams requiring special attention, asbestos being one of them. Asbestos-containing materials such as asbestos pipe wrap, ceiling tiles, and other building materials may be found in structures damaged by the natural disaster. Regulations exist which may affect the demolition, deconstruction of a building, and its subsequent debris removal. To the extent that the demolition or renovation activities are necessary in connection with the building, the requirements of the asbestos regulation under the National Emissions Standard for Hazardous Air Pollutants, also known as NESHAP, may be applicable and can be found at 40 CFR Part 61, Subpart M. NESHAP not only contains requirements for how the material is removed, but also how it is disposed. During Hurricane Katrina, some flexibility was granted to these requirements through a no-action assurance from EPA headquarters. However, these no-action assurances are only issued in extreme circumstances, and most natural disaster responses do not meet this criteria. So the question was, please discuss asbestos handling. Okay, I think I've done that a little bit. There also is some asbestos guidance that is available, and the last slide in this presentation refers you to a website that has that asbestos guidance information. So hopefully that will answer any questions you have. If you do have further questions, then feel free to email me again, jones.nancy@epa.gov, and I will get you all the specifics that you need or refer you to somebody who is an expert in this area. Polychlorified biphenyls may be located in transformers attached to downed utility poles. Debris management should include notification of the local utility if a down pole is encountered. So as part of like the planning effort ahead of time, that should be part of the procedure. If a transformer appears to be leaking and does not have a sticker declaring it's PCB-free, personnel should contact the EPA regional office and the electric utility, as well as restrict access to the area using temporary fencing or barrier tape. PCB cleanup is subject to the Toxic Substance Control Act found at 40 CFR 700-789. And again, there's a website listed on the final slide for more information about that, about management of PCBs and proper cleanup. Medical bio-waste requires special handling, including personnel trained in this area. Use of personal protective equipment and requires disposal at facilities permitted to take this type of waste. And then firearms and ammunition. Let's talk about that on the next slide. So we're going to go to slide 43. So during Katrina and Rita, EPA was tasked to do collection and disposal of firearms and ammunition. Over 2,300 firearms and 96,000 pounds of ammunition and explosives were collected during these two hurricane responses. However, let's move to slide 44. As you can see, in 2007, there was a law that was passed prohibiting the confiscation of firearms. And even though, you know, household hazardous waste collection where materials are left curbside, you wouldn't think that that would be confiscation. But the way that EPA has interpreted this is that no federal employee should collect firearms. So we are prohibited from doing that now, and so we need to coordinate with the local officials, sheriff department, police department on that. So the law further reads, it doesn't show it on this little snippet, but if a federal employee is found to have violated this law, then they're personally liable. And so that's really the big reason why our headquarters office has made the determination and the interpretation that we just can't accept that kind of mission assignment anymore because of the whole personal liability aspect about it. So we did it during Katrina, Rita. We were not able to do it during Gustav and Ike, but we coordinated with the local enforcement agencies, as I said, police and sheriff's departments to make sure it was done. So when materials like that were identified, GPS locations were taken and local entities were contacted. Move to the next slide, slide 45. Ammunition is still okay to collect and can fall under a household hazardous waste mission assignment. So just not the firearms or the explosives, but ammunition is still okay. So then the final slide, 46, is the list of all the websites that I mentioned. I want to point out the third website, the National Strategy for Electronic Stewardship. I want to encourage that if an agency is tasked to do electronic waste collection, that you make sure that you use a certified electronics recycler. A lot of electronic waste ends up being sent to inappropriate places. I'm sure many of you have seen some of those specials about on television about materials going to China. So it's really going to be for your benefit to make sure that this material is recycled appropriately. So the National Strategy for Electronic Stewardship and the next website, the Electronics Institute Alliance, both have information about companies that do proper recycling of e-waste. So please look at those specifically in the website for the National Strategy. If you scroll through the document, I believe it was like on page 11, there's like a little blue link for two different websites. I'll scroll there and read it off to you. One was called R2, and the other one, I believe, was called e-stewardship, but let me find it for you. Just be patient for a moment. Maybe it's further on, but please check out that website and make sure, again, that you're using certified recyclers. So it must not have been page 11, but R2 was one, and the other one, I believe, was called e-stewardship. So, but you can find the link in that document. So just click on that website. It'll take you to the document. And it has little blue links throughout there, and That way you can be sure that you're actually using a certified recycler. So, does anybody else have any questions?
Yeah, I think at this time I'll unmute the phone lines again since I globally muted everyone, and that way if anyone wants to speak up, they can speak up and ask questions. So hold on a second, let me do that.
Okay.
The leader has unmuted your line.
Okay, so now anyone on the phone line that wants to speak up with a question or comment should be able to do that. And then also, folks streaming through the web can continue to use the question mark icon to submit a question. I also encourage you to move on to slide 47, which is our resources and feedback slide, and click on the feedback form, and if you could provide us with your feedback on today's webinar and any you'll see those questions for ideas for future webinars, too. We do read these and tailor our upcoming and future planning based on the feedback that we get from you guys, our customers. So.
And when I moved to look up that website, I got off my little page that had a place for people to show me their questions. Michelle, do you see any other questions?
No, nothing has been submitted.
Okay. Okay.
Good.
Well, if nobody has any questions, then I just want to thank everybody. And, again, I apologize profusely for all the disturbances. Hopefully it didn't mess up the flow too much and that people hung in there with me and you were able to learn something despite the chaos that was going on around me. So thanks again, everybody.
It was great. Thanks for hanging in there, Nancy. I think you did a really good job, and I enjoyed your presentation. And I want to thank everyone also for hanging in. And the webinar will be archived if you want to watch it again in the future. So you should get an email from us indicating when it's available for you to view. And with that, that's the end of today's webinar. You have Nancy's email address. If you have any additional questions or need more information, feel free to contact her. And thanks, everyone, for your attention.